Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Welcome back. Lately, I've been discussing the many, many, many things that affect the therapeutic encounter and kind of sprinkling in some encouragement here and there, and also continuing the exploration in this episode about another couple of factors that are also important to consider when we are working therapeutically. And so I'll share a research article that brings in another view on things. But first, I should also mention that of some of the studies and people's work that I have mentioned before, they're like many things, I suppose, and anything that has to do with humans, there are some debates about how those things work. And as a result, there are also some conflicting studies. I'm not going to list the conflicting studies now. I just feel it's a responsibility to mention them. I will list some in the show notes. I just want to highlight that this is why I tell students all the time that more studies of the same thing are important. I know this sounds strange, but these phenomena are so intense that they're just not easily measured or made sense of. Paul Ekman, someone I've referenced quite a bit, actually wrote an article entitled "What Scientists Who Study Emotion Agree About." I thought that was a pretty straightforward title that explains he's reviewing all the disagreements. So he had to write an article about what they actually may agree about. And to do so, he did a survey of 248 scientists back in 2014 to determine about what things those scientists may agree, and then leaving the other things as possible disagreements. And this was because he received quite a bit of feedback about his assertions on the common expression of universal emotions. So he was responding in part to that, and there have been follow-on articles that take issue with some of the things he found. As for me, in my work as a psychologist who has worked in animal-assisted therapies with both dogs and horses, I have had the experience where animals move their eyes and do other behaviors similar to humans and vice versa. So for me, I know there is something to this. And nevertheless, as a responsible researcher, it's important to continually consider what it is we think we know each time one of these studies has a conclusion. And much of the debate surrounds the idea here that so much of this is culture and context specific. That is to say, these nonverbal signals could be different across cultures. And I would say even within the culture, across age groups at times. And they're also context or, you know, environment and moment-to-moment specific, even for the same person. So I think as we go into that with the responsible view of just acknowledging that and not considering anything to be concrete, we can continue exploring the these avenues. As part of that, I would like to introduce a study now that has a different view on something to consider, and that is that perhaps one of the things that does seem to be consistent as I was researching this is I found multiple studies about how when humans are mimicked by the experimenter in most of these conditions, that it is a pro-social indicator. In other words, it seems to generate pro-social behaviors at all ages. And this has so many implications that feel important to consider from a clinical perspective. So that's where I'd like to go now, is to consider the fact that there are multiple studies at multiple ages that show that when the experimenter mimics the behaviors, either overtly in the case of children or a little less obvious in the case of adults, when the participant in the study has the experience of being mimicked by, you know, someone copying their movements, facial expressions, other behaviors that they do, the participants typically either report that they feel like the encounter had gone more smoothly than in the experimental condition when it didn't happen. And also they report that they have a feeling of liking the experimenter who mimicked them more. And in some studies, they show that the person being mimicked then has a response of wanting to be more helpful and generous toward the experimenter or others in the experiment. And they replicated the study that I'm going to list in the show notes. It is entitled Being Mimicked Increases Pro-Social Behavior in 18-Month-Old Infants. It is by Melinda Carpenter, Johanna Ubel, and Michael Tomasello, published in 2013 in the journal Child Development. And they lead off by summarizing some of these earlier studies, and then their article discusses their research where they replicated this with 18-month-old infants, and they had an experimenter mimic the play behaviors of the children, and then another condition where the children weren't mimicked per se, but they were still interacted with. And the children who had experienced the mimicking or the copying of their behaviors by the experimenter went on to be more helpful to that experimenter and other adults later in the procedure. So it's kind of interesting, right? Just how many ways we interact and our social behaviors are so complex. And as a researcher and clinician, I think these are really important things to consider because this adds to the complexity of the interaction. You know, I think it's very common at this point in adulthood to realize that this is something that happens a lot and it's part of our social development, even. It's important at certain ages that I've spoken about earlier on the podcast in terms of that mirroring function in child development. And, you know, anyone who's ever tried to sell you something will attest to the fact that mimicking behaviors can assist in the sales transaction sometimes. And a lot of times it's not even intentional. I know for myself, as I've been getting really interested in learning more about nonverbal communication and body movements and signals, I have in my own office experienced multiple times where I will be working and I happen to glance around the room and notice that my body position is near mirroring the patient in front of me. And neither one of us were consciously intending to be in a near mirror position to each other. So I think it's just a really important feature of our interaction. I mentioned earlier in the podcast when I was discussing the research I did in my dissertation, I have also noticed many mimicking, because that suggests intentional, like it was in these studies. But there's been many times where I saw dogs mirror human behavior and human mirror dog behavior, and similarly with horses. And it can be just something as simple as like the same look and the same body position, or maybe a little more complex. And for reference here, that would be episodes 2, 3, and 4 on the podcast that have spoken earlier about these things. So there's something to that about our affiliation toward others that we just sort of naturally get into, kind of maybe what is some type of rhythm there. And I just would like to emphasize again, for myself at least, been really considering that as like another variable in the discerning about all these things that we're observing and hearing and listening to and trying to make sense of. This idea that mimicking has such a way that it can be pro-social and encourage affiliative behaviors, that sometimes for myself, I actually try to calm down the mimicking body movements, and maybe when I notice myself do them, I might retract some of them so that I kind of let the other person come into the room a little bit more, if that makes sense. Sort of pull my own reactions back so that they're more free to express themselves verbally and non-verbally in the therapeutic encounter. And it might be a little counterintuitive, like why would I do that? Why would I pull my own behaviors back so that I could make space for the patient in my office? It's probably intuitively obvious that I would want them to make space, but if these mimicking behaviors are kind of affiliative in nature and sort of encourage pro-social behaviors from the other person, why wouldn't I be interested in always doing that? Well, for me, I consider that therapy is a unique type of relationship, and relationships have ups and down moments. And I actually practice in a way that I like to let the person know that if there is a disagreement between us, or if there is just a difference of opinion, that that is not going to crush our rapport. You know, that we can still have a relationship and stay related to one another if we have a difference of an opinion or even a disagreement. And so non-verbally, this is one way to start making space for that, that we don't have to match on everything. We don't have to match opinions. We don't have to match body positions. And it, to me, it helps start setting the frame for there to be discord and also have the experience of a continued relationship and the therapeutic encounter that can sustain that discord and isn't dependent on their affiliation toward me and vice versa. And I find that that tends to strengthen the therapeutic bond, because it's like we trust that it can hold the tension. And that actually, for myself, tends to lead to better long-term outcomes overall. And I raise this in this podcast episode because it's actually quite counterintuitive. And I think important to consider for the long-term therapy treatment. And it just isn't a natural thought at first that that would work as well as it seems to in my experience. But essentially, the larger point here is just how it seems to be no end to the amount of things that affect relationships and, by extension, for this podcast, affect mental health. And as always, I continue to be extremely curious about them and will share findings here on this podcast and appreciate you coming along with me on this journey. Thanks. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.